Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Italian cities were the scene of rallies in solidarity with Gaza and in condemnation of Israel's inhuman attacks against Palestinian civilians. Rome, Florence, Pisa, Syracuse, Grosseto. For the umpteenth time since early October, tens of thousands of people across Italy took to the streets of their respective cities to express their anger at the Italian government for unconditionally supporting the Israeli regime and at the international community for its complicity in Gaza genocide.
Today, more than ever, international law is just an abstract set of norms which prevails over humanity. Millions of people have died since the Sykes-Picot Accord over 100 years ago, and we're still arguing over the fact that Palestine is a state or not.
We'll go down in history as those who silently supported the genocide period.
Italy has not condemned Israel for the killing of unarmed Palestinians collecting aid in Gaza in an attack that killed more than 100 people on Thursday. However, Rome has called on the Israeli regime to investigate the incident and bring the perpetrators behind the aid massacre to justice.
The Italian police crackdown on students during Palestine solidarity demonstrations in the past weeks has sparked outrage across Italy. Student collectives are at loggerheads with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and police over the rise in attacks against students.
The government and police repression has revealed the bare truth. Our country is a democracy only on paper. Ours are simply the democracies of double standards and deception. We have been attacked during our protest for peace in Ukraine, and we are attacked today. We perfectly know how democracies work in Western countries.
Thousands of artists, curators and critics have signed an open letter calling on the Venice Biennale, one of the world's largest contemporary visual art exhibitions, to exclude the Israeli National Pavilion from this year's art exhibition due to the brutal assaults against the civilians in Gaza. However, Italy's culture minister has firmly backed Israel's participation. Max Civili, Rome.
Across France, supporters of Palestine marched to denounce Israel's constant atrocities and war crimes during their latest invasion of Gaza. The world has been stunned by what's been dubbed the Flower Massacre, the death of over 100 Palestinians and the wounding of nearly 800 others after Israeli troops opened fire on civilians waiting for food.
We are here to ask for sanctions and to expose the hypocrisy of those who say they were shocked by the killing of people starving that were getting humanitarian aid, but at the same time don't do anything to stop the genocide.
Some 600,000 people in Gaza, or 25% of the population, are currently at risk of famine.
The French Foreign Ministry said the shootings were unjustifiable and backed a call for an independent investigation by the United Nations. French President Emmanuel Macron demanded truth, justice, respect for international law, and called for an immediate ceasefire.
In the Western world, which is and remains accomplice with the Israeli genocide, but a slight change in the tone of all those Western leaders, including Emmanuel Macron. Remember that a few months ago, Macron was proposing a military coalition to fight the Palestinian resistance in Gaza.
4 years ago, Macron forced through a bill which equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, despite the obvious differences between the two.
Il a deux visages.
Macron is two-faced. It is only since the International Criminal Court announced that they would investigate Israel that Macron began to say just a few words which were not in total support of Israel. He continues to give arms to Israel and is as complicit as the leaders in Tel Aviv.
Many marchers carried signs of deceased United States soldier Aaron Bushnell, who set himself on fire at the Israeli embassy in Washington after declaring that he will no longer be complicit in genocide. After the start of Israel's invasion of Gaza, France imposed a nationwide ban on pro-Palestinian demonstrations around the country. Activists were forced to endure mass arrests, a record number of fines, and the infamous brutality of France's police. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Once a boomtown of the Industrial Revolution, Rochdale in northwest England has been reliably labor for years. Until now. This was an election that saw allegations of fraud, desperate attempts like this one by the right-wing Reform Party.
Make sure you prevent George Galloway from being your MP for Rochdale.
And dominated by the massacre in Gaza.
From the river to the sea.
The result came hours after polls closed.
Hereby declare that George Galloway is duly
a sweeping victory for a veteran anti-war pro-Palestine campaigner who reminded everyone that the anger in Britain over the Gaza genocide is not confined to the Muslim community only.
Every Muslim is bitterly angry at Keir Starmer and his misnamed Labour Party. But you would be very foolish if you did not realize that millions of other citizens of our country are.
Rochdale is home to a 30,000-strong Muslim community.
George Galloway from Rochdale.
Apart from bread-and-butter issues such as the declining public services, unemployment, poverty, and crime that have racked the constituency for years, for the majority of the voters here, there was more to take into account.
This is a blessing to basically take our word straight to Parliament, and if one person just goes in there and asks for a ceasefire, asks for all these genocide to stop, it's more than any Labour candidate or Labour MP or anyone has done for many years.
He can bring change to us locally, but also nationally and internationally. So the thing is, the ongoing issue with Gaza is a big issue, and it's an international issue, but at the same time, it's not just a Muslim issue, it's about human rights.
The election was triggered by the death in January of opposition Labour Party MP Tony Lloyd. He was replaced by this man, Azhar Ali. On voting day, though, Labour's campaign centre lay shuttered after the party abandoned Ali for making anti-Israel remarks.
My elections don't always represent the wider national picture. They are protest votes with a local focus. Last time around, Labour won the seat here by 10,000 votes, but this time they lost. And perhaps that is a sign of what's to come, both for Labour and the Conservatives, with the general elections only months away. Saeed Pourreza, Rochdale, Greater Manchester.
On Thursday, a demonstration was staged in Rome's Parliament Square in protest against the arrest of Anan Yaish, a 37-year-old Palestinian citizen from Tulkarm in the West Bank. Anan was arrested without charge or justifiable cause by the Italian police in the central Italy mountain city of L'Aquila on January 29 on an extradition request by the Israeli government, which Italy's Justice Ministry acquiesced straight away. A month later, Anan, who holds a valid residence permit in Italy since 2017, is still detained in a prison wing housing only terrorists in the city of Terni.
Anan's detention is similar to Israel's administrative detention, when a person is kept in prison without trial, without having committed an offense. Israel even wants to intimidate the Palestinians who live abroad.
Israel believes Anan has committed one and only very serious offense. He has not given up the fight. That's why they are behind him. Italy is surveillance subservient as usual with Israel. Our authorities have arrested an innocent man who is just a member of the Palestinian resistance.
During the demonstration, activists strongly condemned Italy's government for its complicity in the genocide in Gaza.
We know full well how heavy Israel's influence is on the Italian government. Prime Minister Meloni wanted to ban pro-Palestine demonstrations. We have seen her going hand-in-hand with Netanyahu.
More pro-Palestine protests will be held in Italy at the weekend. Large demonstrations will take place in Rome, Florence and Pisa. Meanwhile, a group of Italian lawmakers announced they will travel to the Rafah border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. They say they want to provide the Italian government with a testimony of the tragedy the Palestinians are experiencing as a result of Israel's crimes. Max Civili, Rome.
The new satellite Pars 1 aboard Soyuz launch vehicle was blasted off from a Russian space base and successfully put into orbit 500 kilometers above Earth. The imaging and research satellite will provide a set of remote sensing data that can be used in various fields, including land, forest, water monitoring, and mining and energy transmission lines. The domestically made satellite weighs nearly 150 kilograms and is capable to capture images of 95% of Iranian territory.
The Pars 1 satellite is a two-way researching satellite built by the Iran Space Research Institute and has three types of applications for collecting data from the Earth's surface. The first payload of the color spectrum with an accuracy of 15 meters, the second payload with an accuracy of 150 meters for thermal imaging, and a payload with 300 meters accuracy for imaging with shortwave infrared spectra, which is used to identify plant and forestry pests.
Some Iranians gathered in the country's Space Research Institute to watch the event and express their thoughts about this launch.
We're very proud of this moment. This cooperation between the two countries shows the country's development in international interactions.
I came here today to see this proud moment, and I hope that in the future I can play an influential role in Iran's technological developments.
Pars 1 is designed and manufactured by experts and young scientists with the cooperation of knowledge-based companies. This is the second foreign launch of Iranian satellite. Last year, Iran launched Khayyam satellite from a space launching pad in Kazakhstan. Iran is among the world's top 10 countries capable of developing and launching satellites.
The latest launch is an important step forward in the country's space program. Despite sanctions imposed by Western countries in recent years, Iran is excelling in a wide range of technological developments, including in the space sector. Farzan Ashuryon, Tehran.
Pakistan's newly elected lower house of the parliament met for the first time on Thursday, with freshly elected members taking oaths amid protests on the floor by the supporters of jailed former premier Imran Khan. They called for an audit of the recently held polls in the country.
We will bring back our beloved leader Imran Khan along with the mainstream leadership of our party with the power vested in the newly formed parliament. We demanded on the floor of the House that the chief election commissioner and officials of the electoral body should step down immediately because they were involved in poll rigging and manipulation of results.
Although candidates supported by the imprisoned Khan secured the majority of seats in the country's National Assembly, the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz and Pakistan People's Party, along with their political allies, have united in an alliance to establish a coalition government. They have nominated former Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif as their candidate for the country's chief executive position for a second term. Khan's opponents say that the democracy has emerged victorious, while those setting up obstacles in the way of country's progress and prosperity have been defeated.
We consider Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf as a roadblock to the country's progress and prosperity. They are attempting to sabotage democracy through the rhetoric of poll rigging and are striving to foment anarchy in the country.
Efforts from the government coalition to persuade its former key ally have encountered a hurdle with the leader of Pakistan's primary religious political faction, affirming its decision to refrain from participating in the formation of the government. Once the head of the former coalition, the chief of Jamiat Ulama-e-Islam, Maulana Fazlur Rahman, parted ways with the newly formed coalition and decided not to be involved in forming the new government.
A hung parliament in Pakistan has been sworn in amid allegations of poll rigging and results manipulation. Experts say that the formation of a coalition government in the country with a split mandate would face severe political challenges in the days to come. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
As a result of a broad consensus in Iraq to end the presence of U.S.-led international coalition forces from the country, both the Iraqi nation and government made it crystal clear that these military forces are no longer needed. Iraqi National Security Advisor Qasem al-A'raji stated that all political factions in the country have agreed on the need to end the presence of U.S.-led military coalition purportedly formed to fight Daesh terrorist group.
Today we're witnessing the negotiation with the international coalition forces, and honestly, what makes us, the Iraqi people, exasperated is the insistence by the U.S. to keep its troops on our land to have an intervention in the military scene of Iraq and neighboring Syria.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani stated that the Western Alliance mission will end at the Baghdad government's official request. He also said that the government is setting a date for the start of bilateral committee talks, which includes representatives of the military coalition, to put arrangements to end the presence of international coalition forces in Iraq permanently.
We have collected more than 100 signatures and prepared the legal draft to end the international coalition mission in Iraq. And we pledge before God to our people that we will enact the law to expel the foreign forces from our land.
The demands to end U.S. military presence in Iraq are not new. After Washington's assassination of top Iraqi and Iranian anti-terror commanders, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Mohandis, 4 years ago, Iraqi parliament voted to expel foreign forces who can endanger security and stability in Iraq and jeopardize civil peace. Following the recent attacks on anti-terror forces and the continued violations on the country's sovereignty, the Iraqi nation and government are now determined to end the presence of foreign military forces to prevent any further escalations that can endanger the stability and security of Iraq. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
According to the British Retail Consortium, shop thefts in England have more than doubled in the past 3 years, costing retailers some £953 million a year. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. UK shop workers are facing 1,300 incidents of violence and abuse a day and a battle to control brazen acts of shoplifting as pressure mounts on ministers to intervene to protect retail employees. According to the British Retail Consortium, the trade body which represents most major shops retailers in Britain, retailers saw the number of incidents of racial abuse, sexual harassment, physical assaults and threats with weapons rise 50% last year, while thefts more than doubled to 16.7 million incidents. The rise in retail crime has coincided with a period of rampant price inflation, with the cost of everyday goods from eggs to baby formula increasing over the past 2 years at a rate not seen since records began in the 1970s, leaving many families struggling to make ends meet. Some experts argue that efforts to cut labour costs by using technology such as self-checkouts have contributed to the problem, while retailers are blaming a rise in organised crime and scarce police resources. Helen Dickinson, the British Retail Consortium's chief executive, called for police to step up the number of arrests. Helen Dickinson said, despite retailers investing huge sums in crime prevention, violence and abuse against retail workers is climbing. Criminals are being given a free pass to steal goods and to abuse and assault retail colleagues. No one should have to go to work fearing for their safety. The number of thefts has quadrupled on a pre-pandemic levels. Violence and abuse, which fell after a spike during the lockdowns of 2020, have jumped back up and are now three times higher than before the pandemic. The latest figures come after almost 90 retail leaders, including the bosses of Tesco, Sainsbury's, Boots and WH Smith, wrote to the government in October, demanding action on rising retail crime, as they said violent criminals were emptying stores. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered this story and tells us more. Retailers want the British government to introduce a standalone offence of assaulting, threatening or abusing a retail worker, arguing that this would enable police to understand the scale of the issue and send a message that such crimes are being taken seriously. Under a similar law introduced in Scotland in 2021, retail crimes now carry tougher sentences and require police to record all incidents of retail crime and allow the allocation of more resources. Helen Dickinson, the British Retail Consortium's chief executive, said, "Why should our hard-working colleagues south of the border be offered less protection?" Katie Bourne, the Sussex Police and Crime Commissioner, who is the lead for business crime at the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners, said the levels of retail crime being reported were unprecedented, adding, "Every day retail staff are facing the consequences of shoplifting, brazen behaviour, and that's why I have supported the call for a specific offence of assault on a shop worker." She added, "Our courts need to work more efficiently and shoplifters need to be deterred from re-offending." The Co-op, which has more than 2,000 stores across the United Kingdom, said it was installing 200 secure till kiosks, locked cabinets for expensive goods and artificial intelligence technology to monitor self-checkouts in its supermarkets after a 44% surge in retail crime last year. It has also doubled the amount it spends on security guards. Last year, the fashion and homeware retailer Nexus boss Simon Wolfson also said he had seen a rise in shoplifting which had hit profit margins at Next. That came after John Lewis said it suffered a £12 million year-on-year increase in theft, with its chair, Sharon White, calling shoplifting an epidemic. Paul Gerrard from the Co-op said, "The majority of thefts were by people stealing to sell on goods in large volumes, and could be accompanied by threats of abuse. Gerard added, "People are being followed home from work. I know of one example where we had to move people for their own safety." He said violent theft happened in city centres and leafy market towns, with professional criminals moving on to other stores if extra security measures were put in place at a favoured target. Co-op stores in some areas were reporting more than 2 incidents a week, where criminals have jumped over till kiosks to steal cigarettes, lottery cards and cash. However, Paul Gerard said, there had been green shoots in the past few months as a result of the government's Retail Crime Action Plan published in October, which includes a police commitment to prioritise attending reports of shoplifting involving violence against a shop worker or where security guards have detained an offender. The plan also involves the more controversial Project Pegasus, under which 10 of the country's biggest retailers, including Marks & Spencer, Boots and Primark, are handing CCTV images to police to be run through databases using facial recognition technology in an effort to identify prolific or potentially dangerous individuals. Paul Gerard said police attendance at incidents at co-op stores had shot up to 60% from 20% in October, which was a real step forward. He said, until October, there was no risk in engaging in that type of activity, and now there is a real risk of being arrested and prosecuted. Recently, a coalition of Britain's largest retail associations, including the British Retail Consortium and the Association of Convenience Stores, sent a letter to every police and crime commissioner in England and Wales, decrying a level of shoplifting that they said was having an enormous financial impact on businesses. They said retailers are facing unprecedented levels of shop theft in their stores, with many now seeing organised looting of their businesses on a regular basis. Yet, the Association of Convenience Stores, which represents more than 30,000 local shops, told the Financial Times that shoplifting in its sector had risen to a level it had never seen before. It argued that the discrepancy between the experience of retailers and official statistics was because of a lack of crimes against business, only 16% by its estimation being reported.
Doing us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. While protests continue to be held throughout the world denouncing the Israeli genocide in Gaza, on Saturday, Europeans made their voices heard as they took to the streets in many cities, from Vienna, Madrid, Rome to London, Berlin and The Hague all have witnessed massive demonstrations in solidarity with the Palestinian people and calling for an end to the Israeli genocide. Other parts of the world also continue to have demonstrations, such as the United States, South America. People are calling for a ceasefire now, and they say no to a ground attack on Rafah. But as they make their voices heard, the Holocaust continues so far, leaving over 30,300 people slaughtered, most of them women and children. When will the world say enough? is enough. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of New York, Margaret Kimberly, co-founder of Black Agenda Report. And out of Arsene, New York, Don DeBar, activist and commentator.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Nice to see you. Starting it off with Margaret. Margaret, when you see these demonstrations continuing despite that it has been many months now, I mean, what does that say to you? What exactly does it mean?
Well, it tells us that the world is with Palestine. Regardless of what governments do, regardless of what the U.S. says, the EU says, any of their allies and puppet states, the people of the world are with Palestine. It's very clear. There is revulsion around the world at the sight of the war crimes, of the genocides. And I remind your viewers, war crimes are defined. Genocide is defined. Israel's a signatory to the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. And it's very clear there is intentional harm to a group of people. There is collective punishment. So people know this now. And we have to ask ourselves why, despite the fact that people want an end to the killing, most Americans want a ceasefire. Despite their differences in opinion about U.S.-Israel policy, Americans want a ceasefire, but that is the last thing they will get. And that has to be our question about supposed so-called democracies that don't do what the people want.
Well, Don, it is important to note that many protesters have had to pay a price for their anti-Zionist stance. Let's discuss some of the obstacles that have been placed on pro-Palestine demonstrators, from losing their jobs, demonized, arrested, blocked social media, etc. I mean, your thoughts on this overall?
Well, it's more extensive than that also. Start, for example, with some of the laws that have been put into place over the last 3-4 years or more or less in places like New York State, where if you're a state employee, if you called for a boycott, the BDS program, you can lose your employment and your pension and everything else. These are pretty unique, really, pieces of legislation and restraints on speech in this country historically. As bad as things have been from time to time and altogether over time, the fact that you can't even broach the subject of divesting or sanctioning Israel in a public or even a semi-public forum without losing your employment, that this is, I won't say unprecedented, but again, unique. The condition that is giving rise to this, obviously, is that the most horrific crime in the history of humanity that's been televised is being televised right now. This, given the extent of media coverage and the saturation of the audience, which is global at this point, it even makes the coverage of the Vietnam War in the 1960s pale by comparison. You know, that went on for, well, if you want to, how far back you want to go, but the TV coverage here went on from maybe 1962, 1963, until the war was finally ended in early 70s. Every night people got a body count, like, as if they were watching a football game or whatever. But now we're seeing coverage across the board from people on the ground, no mediation for a lot of it, and people are getting a real sense of what this actually is. And they get to see, when they see what it actually is, the huge vector between what actually is and what the people that are supposedly their leaders are telling them is going on, and the way that the media that they've been following for most of their lifetimes has been portraying it. And it's creating a real contradiction, I think, in people's, you know, minds, you know, a cognitive dissonance that's been kind of unprecedented socially, that's giving rise to these things in a condition, by the way, where people are still suffering massively economically and in almost every other area of their lives. So there's some real revolutionary potential here, and we're even starting to see some of that bleed into reality.
Well, what about that, Margaret? Don talked about the cognitive dissonance. When we look at the situation and the growing schism between the people and the governments, and what the people want and what the governments deliver, let's talk about possibilities, because Don said this can be a real revolutionary moment. Do you think that they're making that connection, that this is really, it is, of course, the main situation at hand is the genocide in Gaza, but the other part of that is their governments and actually becoming aware of really what their governments stand for?
Well, people know what their governments stand for, but we are told in the U.S. that we don't have any options except to vote and to vote for the main party candidates for the duopoly. Donald Trump has not made clear what he would do differently, if he would do anything differently than Biden. He was a strong supporter of Israel when he was president before, so we can only assume he would do the same thing. But this is a moment, and it's not just Israel. This is emblematic of the political system as a whole, that it does not do what the people want. And people are demonized, terrorized into thinking they don't have any options except to vote and to vote for the people who continually do what they don't want to have done. I think you're going to see an increase in voting for smaller party candidates, and I hope you see actually fewer people participating at all. And I hope that we see Americans starting to ask themselves about the political system, about whether or not it really is a democracy, about whether or not their only choice is to vote and to vote for these two parties that have no legitimacy with millions of people.
Well, Don, how likely is it to see even more action by Americans? How about April 15th is coming up? How about not paying their taxes? Because as they become more and more aware of what their tax dollars are going for, wouldn't that be a great possibility or likely conclusion?
It's not a battlefield to choose to fight this war on, although it might be sort of a, you know, ancillary site. First of all, most people pay their taxes, most people that are working or that have an income stream pay their taxes as they make the income. So that money is already in the hands of the government. The documentation they have to file by April 15th is to reclaim their share of it in the event that it was overtaken and overpaid, or to make up for a deficiency. Then, even if it were effective, however, the power that's granted to the Internal Revenue Service, in other words, to the collection arm of the U.S. government, is so vast and so extensive that the moment their computer tells them that you didn't pay your share, they can go on a hunt and seize your property, put a lien against your house, clean out your bank account, whatever, with really very little opportunity to fight. So this is an area where all you're going to do is lose, basically. Because of the way the media is set up, you're not going to really have an opportunity for anyone to even know that you did it. People are just going to wonder how you ended up on the street. But this does raise a question to me, because we're seeing people in the streets now, you know, all over the world about Gaza. They're, industries, for example, in Europe over other things, and I'd like to get to that later. But, you know, we did this with Iraq. It's very good to see people mobilize, first of all, because it says, A, they're aware of what's going on, B, they have a serious enough problem with it to get off their behinds and out of their lives and come into the streets and try to do something about it. But we've seen also, it's not terribly effective, if it's effective at all. And if it is effective, it's effective on a very long, slow curve. And when you have a genocide going on, the people at the other end of the genocide don't really have that much time. You know, we can settle the question of whether this was wrong or not well after the time that it's done. And it doesn't do much good to the people who are being killed. And it doesn't even do much as an example to make sure that never again is really never again this time. We have to start formulating some things that we can do to stop things now. And I think that's where a lot of our, you know, thinking and a lot of our work has to be placed at the moment, to figure out things that are effective in a much more immediate sense and start trying them out and seeing what works.
Okay, I'm going to get back to you on that. But, Margaret, it's not just Europe, of course, but other parts of the world that are denouncing the Israeli genocide, also places like Caracas and Havana. Do you think we're on the verge of a global transition and increased solidarity against not only the Israeli regime, but also its supporters?
Oh, I definitely think so. That's definitely the case. The problem, as Don DeBar pointed out, is that the people who fled to Rafah for protection and who are now being killed by Israel don't have that kind of time. There is a change in the world. The unipolar world, where the U.S. Felt it could control the whole planet for the past 30 years, is clearly over. But we don't see, as of yet, a formation that is willing to take action to stop this. And I think we have to talk about other countries, too, and what they do and don't do. How many countries have ended diplomatic relations with Israel? How many of them are trying to send supplies to the people in Gaza? There are Arab governments, Egypt, which is going along with this ethnic cleansing plan. It's a U.S. puppet state, and I think we need to protest them too. Mm-hmm. There was an oil embargo 50 years ago in the 70s by the oil-producing states in the region. We don't see any talk of that now.
Right.
So while this these political formations are changing, it's not changing fast enough to help the people of Gaza.
Well, Don, in Washington, D.C., protests and sit-ins continue in front of the Zionist embassy, where American airman Aaron Bushnell lit himself on fire in protest of the Israeli genocide. Do you think that after his death, more Americans are becoming more aware of their responsibility in general for this genocide, their tax dollars? After Bushnell wrote, quote, "What would I do if my country was committing genocide? You're doing it right now."
Very good question. Back in 1963, there were a couple of Buddhist monks that lit themselves on fire in protest of the U.S. war in Vietnam. And then in 1965, Norman Morrison lit himself on fire outside the Pentagon in the full view of then Defense Secretary Robert McNamara. And McNamara has spoken subsequently about the impact that that had on him. But that war didn't end for another 8 years. Now, Aaron Bushnell was standing outside of the Israeli embassy. And let's say it's him with whatever the device is, but we'll call it a Molotov cocktail or something filled with an accelerant that you light a match and hit the target. There's two potential targets there while he's standing there, and I'm not advocating hitting either one of them. But the reality is he could have either turned that on himself, as he did, and that's one set of outcomes that come with it, and or he could have thrown it at the embassy, and that's another one. And then the question would be is, one, what is the following, what follows from what he actually did? And then also, what would follow if he had turned it the other way? What would the reaction, what would the response be? And I think all of the things that we're looking at right now, we have to look at in that context. What is going to follow from doing this? What do we have as historical precedent? And how does that play against the timeline of trying to save these people from being, you know, extinct?
Yeah. Well, Margaret, let's look at the world in general. Do you feel that the world is becoming more aware of who the real axis of evil is and who the real axis of resistance is and the importance of this?
Oh, yes. I think people around the world know that the people we're always told we shouldn't like, the people we're supposed to hate as being terrorists, we're supposed to hate as being evil, are not. It's the people directing us, propagandizing us. That's the axis of evil, and people know it. That's why you see millions of people around the world protesting. Here in New York yesterday, it was a pouring rain, and still thousands of people came out. So people know. The question is, what are they going to do? Aaron Bushnell, his act was one of frustration, of the powerlessness that people feel. I think people need to have more of a revolutionary mindset and think about other things they can do rather than destroying themselves in hopes of changing policy. You know, he's the second person to self-immolate. Someone did in Atlanta who apparently survived, but that person was disappeared. Their name has never been given, their age, their gender, nothing. Mm-hmm. And we're told this, the law enforcement and the media covered it up completely. So Aaron Bushnell is actually the second person to do this. But that degree of frustration is not what we want to see. We want to see action. And we, if nothing else, we have to start out with the question of what we do differently.
And let's start from there, Don, because you already talked about the protests, that how effective are they at the end of the day. We saw a lot of protests in 2003 and run up before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and that didn't change anything. So what's next? What should be done in your perspective?
I think we're going to see some examples of what can be done taking shape, particularly in Europe. It's not written about much here. They'll talk about farmers' protests in the same way that they did about the truckers, basically, that is some kind of anti-immigrant response and racist, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, what's happening in Europe right now is that the large capital formations in the West, Vanguard, et cetera, have taken over the bulk of the usable farmland in Ukraine on the cheap under the conditions that have existed there for the last four or five years. And they are starting to dump crops into the European market at the same time that there's like a 1-2 punch being delivered to the farmers over the so-called global warming concerns. And so having endured 40 or 50 years already of all kinds of austerity and rollbacks in various public subsidies, etc., people's backs are to the wall who never expected they would get there. This like the middle class of Europe that is now forced into the trenches with the workers, and those who are even worse off than the workers have been rendered. We're seeing an expression of anger and frustration in the context of an understanding that the institutions are no longer legitimate. And that is now happening where even the moral face of the parties in order is, you know, are being exposed as genociders in front of the whole world. So I think the kind of response we're watching form in Europe is going to include some technologies for you know, revolutionary activity that we haven't seen before, that we might look to and study and perhaps adapt to our own conditions if they're appropriate. I have spent a little time now on two separate trips with the Yellow Vests in Paris, for example, and heard conversations that they have about, you know, just they've been trying to maintain a basic organizational presence on the streets of Paris since the first time I was there was in 2018. And as these things flare up, there are different groups, Communist Party, Socialist Party, et cetera, that have an infrastructure that people can latch onto. Again, I think we're going to start seeing like a maturing of revolutionary technology on the streets of Europe that we can look to for maybe for some advice.
Okay. What about the streets of the United States, Margaret? Your thoughts?
Well, I believe that these protests are going to continue, and they're going to intensify. But the question remains, what else people will turn to? Will it be self-destruction, like in the case of Aaron Bushnell, or will it be under some sort of revolutionary action? And that can mean a variety of things. But I think what is clear is that the system has no legitimacy. For millions of people, there are cracks, even among the ruling class. Don mentioned funding Ukraine. There's disagreement about whether to continue it. This has been a bipartisan policy, and now some Republicans want to stop that funding, although the same hasn't happened about Israel. So I think people need political education to figure out what steps to take next that would be more effective and take advantage of this moment. This is, you know, there are people who think, you know, that by osmosis there are going to be changes. No, it's the people who have to make the change. The arc of the moral universe does not bend towards justice unless people demand that it does, unless right. people force it to. So that's the question now. Are the people going to act on their feelings of disenfranchisement, their realization that they don't live in democracies? How are people going to respond on the subject of Israel and others?
Okay. Well, Don, at the bottom line, do you think there's anything that is going to stop this Holocaust besides the resistance itself?
Well, resistance, of course. Question is, what kind of resistance focuses on what points, what's effective, who can sustain what long enough to deal with what's coming from Israel and really from the United States through Israel. it's a war. Israel and the United States, or the United States is at war with the people of Palestine, with the people of that region, pretty much with the whole world, using various agencies in this particular battle, I guess, of Gaza. It's with the Israeli military as a front. But it's the same war that's being fought in Ukraine, and it's the same war that's being fought in a variety of places in Latin America and Asia, whether it's in the brush and Africa. It's the same enemy. It's humanity on one side, and the elite that dominates the structures of Europe, Asia, Japan, South Korea, a few other places, on the other. We don't know who's in the castle now. We just know that all of our things are being taken from us and dragged there, and someone's consuming them and coming back and beating hell out of us all the time. You used to be able to go to the castle and drag them out and off with their head, and things were better for a while. We don't know who that is now. We're looking at something that was meant to survive a nuclear war and still function. So we have to figure out how capturing the this is the reason I always looked at January 6th as a joke. Capturing the Congress would not capture the U.S. government. Of course not. If Congress were hit with a nuclear weapon, the U.S. government would not fall. It was designed to survive that. That's what the internet is.